Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by John Rurink and Tom Hickson. We're going to be talking with Tom here in just a second. And also, we've got the incoming Senate Minority Leader, Jim Ananick. But first, John, I thought we'd go over a little bit where we are with the state party chair races right now. Obviously, Bobby Shostak is the chair of the Republican Party and would seem to be the odds-on favorite to serve a third term if he wants it. We don't know if he does or not yet. We're going to be waiting to see what we hear either way on that front. But if he does not, we already are hearing some names that are rumbling around. Pete Lund is a possibility, state representative, term limited out of office. Jeff Sakwa, who ran for the MSU Board of Trustees, is a possibility. Some have also mentioned Terry Land, who ran for the U.S. Senate, but obviously was not successful in that. So some names to look out for. And then obviously the Tea Party usually has an interest in this race, and that person could come at any point, really. We know it's not going to be Todd Corser, since he's going to be a state representative here on January 1st, but there is always somebody, it seems like, emerging from that side of the party, and they could be a late emerger. So just because we don't hear anybody yet doesn't mean that there won't be anybody. I'm also reminded when we had that national committeeman race, John, when it looked like Saul Anousis was going to win re-election fairly easily, Dave Ajima came out fairly late in that cycle and quickly emerged, got the momentum, and won that race. On the other side, Lon Johnson, the first-term chair for the Michigan Democratic Party, seems like he would be in good shape. You know, obviously there's some rumbling, there's some people who aren't happy, but it really comes down to what the UAW wants to do, and as of right now, it doesn't look like they're necessarily politically activated on that front as of yet. They're still doing some assessing. And, you know, without the UAW really leading the charge against anybody else, it would seem Lon Johnson would be all right. But again, we haven't heard any names and really no reason to believe that there's anybody else out there as of right now. All right, John, well, we've got Tom here. Go right for it.
All right, we're joined this morning by Tom Hickson, the Michigan Catholic Conference. Tom, you are advocating a piece of legislation that would bring the state of Michigan in line with the U.S. Law in terms of protecting religious freedom. It's kind of gotten caught up a little bit with the whole Elliot Larson civil rights expansion. You'd like to see it move independently on its own merit. Talk to us why it's important. As a religious person, why does this have to happen?
Well, I think it's very timely even to talk about this week. You know, later on Thursday, it's the 400th anniversary, roughly, of the Pilgrims landing at Plymouth Rock. Not exactly the 400th, but right around. And they came here from England to escape religious intolerance. And as you can see throughout the history, people have come to this country for centuries looking for freedoms, namely to be able to believe and act out in the public square their beliefs and be able to, without being persecuted. If you fast forward that to today and to actually, let's go to 1990, there was a monumental case called the Smith case. Before that time, it was widely understood that the First Amendment to the Constitution protects everybody's religious freedom and free exercise, really, to be able to act in public, to speak out publicly about their beliefs, and to get involved in, for instance, Catholic charities to help the poor in a method according to their beliefs. That 1990 case involved Native Americans and the use of peyote. And at that time, the Supreme Court essentially said these Native Americans who were using peyote for a religious ceremony were violating the law. And the religious nature of that ceremony, the tribe believed they were able to do that and not be persecuted. Well, that really kind of set the tone of the next 20 or so years, 20, 24 years. What we thought the First Amendment protected really does not protect. So in 1993, President Clinton and Democratic Senator Charles Schumer from Pennsylvania enacted the United States Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it was allowed to give people a balancing test, and essentially to say if something is passed by the state or by the federal government, it shouldn't be burdening your religious beliefs. And if it does, there has to be a compelling governmental interest to do that. And if there's a compelling governmental interest to do that, then the second side of that coin is that the least restrictive means to accomplish that goal. And since that time, that act initially was supposed to apply to all 50 states. That's since been overturned, and so now you're seeing individual states pass Religious Freedom Restoration Act at the state level. So right now, the federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act only applies to federal action.
How many states have it?
19. Okay. Yeah, we've got states, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Texas, Florida. And it runs the gamut.
Now, the speaker sort of rolled out his introduced version, and it's been introduced in Michigan before, is my understanding.
It has. In fact, Kirk Prophet, he's mm-hmm. a lobbyist now in town, good guy, good friend, Democratic member, introduced this back in the 90s, and it passed the House, actually.
He introduced it kind of tied to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. Why shouldn't it be tied, and what have you been hearing as far as the ability to sort of uncouple these issues? I mean, they're not tie-barred, but...
They're not tie-barred at all. You know, we're supportive of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's our main focus moving forward.
Yeah, I had a question for you, Tom. First off, on that issue, which you just mentioned, would you guys support the RFRA bill if it passes, only if the Elliot Larson change passes with it? Have you guys taken a position?
Like I said, our main focus is passing the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You know, the two bills are not tie-barred. You know, we don't believe that someone should be discriminated against because of their sexual orientation. That's for sure. That's Catholic teaching going back centuries and centuries. But our focus, again, is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
I think on both sides of kind of the Elliot Larson thing and the RFRA bill, there's always this conversation for examples of where this bill would actually have an impact. Could you provide some examples where this is unfolded in Michigan that shows the need for this?
Absolutely. You know, I can talk about some examples outside of the state, and then there's some examples right here in the state. In the state, we've got an example of a woman that was looking to post to get a roommate, to split the rent with someone, and said desired a Christian roommate. The Department of Civil Rights came in and said that's discrimination. And, you know, of course somebody has a right to say I want to share a room and split a room with somebody that shares. Outside of the state, you've got someone that's of the Sikh tradition. Was asked, they were in ROTC, they were asked to cut their beard. The person said, no, I don't want to cut the beard. And interestingly enough, the ACLU has jumped in to defend this person. Hmm. It shouldn't be lost that years ago, the ACLU and many other groups were among the strongest proponents of passing a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You know, we've got a couple of other issues, too, around the country. There's an issue down in Fort Lauderdale and in Pennsylvania of some church groups. In fact, the one in Fort Lauderdale, it's a minister and a 90-year-old man wanted to do what they felt was their duty, their religious right to feed homeless people in the park. Well, city of Fort Lauderdale passed an ordinance that said you're not allowed to feed the homeless. It's like Yogi Bear, don't feed the don't give them the picnic basket, for the Jellystone Park there. But basically, these people are trying to act out their religious faith to help the poor, and they were arrested because they were feeding homeless people. So this is a classic example of where Religious Freedom Restoration Act would allow people to say, you know what, I think I've got a right to assert my faith in the public square. Mm-hmm. Another example, in Houston, Texas, there was an ordinance that was an anti-discrimination ordinance and it added sexual orientation. The mayor and the city council wanted to subpoena pastors' sermons before they issued them on the Sunday. So we need to review these to make sure they're okay. I mean, that's a classic violation of somebody's religious rights and acting out their faith, even within the sanctuary. We think that it's not limited to be within the sanctuary. We think people can act day-to-day life. Mm-hmm. Catholic charity agencies, we've been in the business for hundreds and hundreds of years of providing for adoption and foster care and helping out refugee resettlement. Right here, St. Vincent Catholic Charities in Lansing has helped out with many of the different folks from Asia and Africa that are refugees from war-torn countries, helping them, you know, get clothing and shelter here. In Massachusetts, in Illinois, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., we've seen Catholic charity agencies have to either pull back on what they do or actually close down altogether in the case of Illinois because of fear of persecution from the government because they don't happen to do foster care and adoption the way that the state felt they had to do it.
A couple quick questions, again, going back to the proponents of the Elliot Larson expansion. They've kind of argued that a couple of things. That number one, this is a right-wing proposal. They've also suggested that if this passes, it could make the placement of children with same-sex couples difficult. and could present other challenges. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I would say this is not a right-wing proposal. I don't think religious liberty is something that's right or left or Democrat or Republican. I think someone's conscience is innate to themselves. And I think in no way would this impact anything to do with people that want of the same sex that want to adopt or be engaged in foster care. There's certainly room for that. What we're trying to do here, however, is protect a wide range and diversity and show tolerance among all people and among all faiths and people of non-faith. And we think that this would do that.
One of the issues that gained some attention last week was the whole question of immigration. The president's announced some executive actions he's taking to deal with up to 5 million illegal aliens or undocumented workers. The church has been pretty active in helping that whole community. What was your reaction to what he did?
Well, a couple things. You know, I think that that's solid policy from our vantage point because people deserve their human dignity and respect. We don't recognize, you know, if somebody is, because they may not have a paper, that they don't deserve food and water, they don't deserve to be, have some kind of dignity shown to them. Was it the best way to handle it? You know, that I think we need to make sure we take a step back, involve Congress, involve the president, have a bipartisan solution, and try to have a complete comprehensive reform. For those folks that are undocumented, that was, you can see the reactions of those people. I think they were very pleased what the president did. So I think it's a step. I think hopefully you can get some cooperation from all parties here. I think there's an interest there by both the Congress and the president to do that. And I think ultimately we need to have a little bit of more harmony and not just a one-upping and a gotcha game that we've seen for so many years, and have a comprehensive solution that's going to solve the problem for all those folks that are in that situation.
As we approach next week, lawmakers are returning for the final 3 weeks. Anything you've got on your agenda besides the Religious Freedom and Restoration Act?
You know, these are our major interests. You know, we obviously are involved in education policy quite a bit, too. You know, 90% of our students go to public schools. You know, the rest are going to go to Catholic schools. But we think that regardless of what type of a school you go to, we need to make sure the education opportunities are sound here in Michigan. You know, we've seen all the various states around in the Great Lakes or the Big Ten states, however you want to look. And all of them are jumping ahead of Michigan. Mm-hmm. You know, we think this governor's done a tremendous job opening up opportunities for alternative types of learning. And we think that's a start, but we think that discussion needs to proceed. I don't know if you'll see anything per se on lame duck with that. You know, we're always interested in trying to help the poor. But I think it really boils down to the utmost civil right, civil liberty that somebody should be protected on is how you believe how you want to carry that out in your day-to-day life. And I think that is something that's paramount. And from that, other things can flow.
Thank you for coming in, Tom.
Thank you.
Join me on the other end of the line, Senate Minority Leader-elect Jim Ananick. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Seems to be a lot of things lining up for the calendar for lame duck. Is there anything in particular that you would like to see passed, or would you just prefer to see the session end and we start anew in the new year?
My general reaction is normally to say I'm not a big fan of lame duck. We're not accountable to the voters, but since we're going to have one, I'm hopeful that we're going to move forward with transportation funding, because I think the sooner we get that done, the better. Yeah, I mean, the voters, citizens want it, and I think we need to deliver it this year.
Is there anything else that Democrats would like to see passed? Obviously, you guys have taken care of this on the Senate side, and so it's over in the House. So the Senate's going to meet. Is this just a case where you try and get as little as the Republican agenda through as possible, or is there still some things on the wish list that you guys could get through?
Well, you know, there's always things that, you know, that we're going to be fighting for, you know, when it comes to making sure jobs in the economy, making sure that everyone benefits as the economy starts to improve. And if we can find ways to get those things done, we're more than happy to work with them on it. At the same time, I have a lot of members that probably have some personal priorities they've been working on. If I can help get some of those through, I'd like to see that happen as well. But we'll see. You know, we'll see what the Republicans put forward and see what things we can work with them on and see what things we're going to, you know, ultimately oppose. You know how lame duck is. I mean, something that seems like it's going to happen for sure quite often doesn't happen, and things that you think had no shot at going go through. So it's an unusual time, so we'll have to kind of see what's before us.
Moving or switching gears here a little bit, let's talk about the election that just happened here. Obviously, you guys had to be disappointed by what happened, your caucus shrinking by 1-11. How do you keep spirits up? How do you keep people excited and motivated and trying to move toward a situation where you guys could take majority at a certain point?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the results were not what we wanted, and I think, you know, us in the caucus, throughout the state and nationally, have to look at, you know, what we did right, what we did wrong, and what we need to do differently going forward. And that those discussions are, you know, ongoing. So as a party, we're going to be looking at that. But the part about, you know, how do we keep individual members and Democrats engaged? You know, we have a very talented crew, you know, coming back and two members joining us. And they're all dedicated to the issues that we care about and getting things done for Michigan. I don't think it's going to be a very hard sell to keep them involved or to get them more involved. So, you know, I mean, you have elections, and sometimes you have bad ones, and sometimes you have good ones. And, you know, we have to figure out a way to make sure that in the off-election years, you know, we're able to get our message across and motivate people to vote. So, you know, that's a good question, and that's something we're going to have to keep working on. But I think with the talented, dedicated people we have, it's going to be something that we can answer pretty easily and come up with a good agenda that we want to see going forward.
I wanted to ask you how your relationship is with the Senate Majority Leader-elect, Arlen Meekhoff. How do you feel like that relationship's going to go in the immediate and upcoming future?
Yeah, I mean, in immediate, it's good. And I think it's going to get better as we go forward. to be fair, you know, I've only been in the Senate for a year and a half now. I don't have a lot of deep relationships with anybody. I have some pretty strong ones that I think I'm going to build on. But being the new guy, you know, I don't have the length of time with other people. But with Arlen, I think him and I will be able to work pretty well together. I mean, he seems to be his style. It's pretty open, pretty straightforward, and that's how I operate. I think he knows that when I can be with him, you know, I'll be there. When I can, I'm not going to play games. I'll just let him know. And I think my style and his will yield some good results for the citizens.
How do you see this caucus being different than the current caucus as far as what maybe some objectives are, if it's going to be different at all?
You know, I think I want to have a real frank and thorough discussion with my colleagues that are going to be coming back with me next term and ask them, you know, what their priorities are. You know, there's sort of obviously fundamentals of the Democratic Party that we all sort of believe in that, you know, obviously we'll fight for, but, you know, what's going forward do they want to see us talking about and have an agenda? Because I think one of the failings of this election was that nationally, even not just here, but nationally, we didn't have an agenda that we were running on. It was more of sometimes a response or a critique of the other side. And I think it's important, even when you're in a minority, a deep minority like we're in, that we articulate a vision for what we want to see. I'm looking forward to having that conversation with my colleagues and developing that.
Talk about the balance that you see between scoring political points, being in the minority where the Republicans don't need you to pass policy, and trying to get what policy you can passed. Talk about the balance in those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a firm believer that, you know, we were sent here for a purpose. You know, there was I think Sam Rayburn said it, when he lost control of the House, I think during the 50s under Eisenhower, any jackass can knock down a barn, takes a carpenter to build one. And I think with the talented folks that we have, I think we're going to be able to work to make legislation better, to make policies better because of our input, and that's what we're going to try to do. Now, obviously, there's going to be times when we just fundamentally disagree, and I wouldn't consider it to be – I understand the term, and I don't take issue with it, but I think – in this case, it's not going to be to make political points. It's going to be when we just have just opposition. We just fundamentally don't agree is when I see us opposing things. I've never been a gotcha kind of politician. You know, I don't believe that that's the way to win. I think you build a strong team and you put together a good structure for your political, and you do the work you need to do. And in election time, you make sure you get your voters out. So I think that there's going to be plenty of things that we'll see differently with Republicans in the next 4 years that we'll be able to articulate in an election in 2018, and then we'll make hopefully significant gains. But I see that my role is to assess the issue in front of me at the time and work with my colleagues to try to make it better when we can and articulate the differences when we can.
The goal, I think, this past election was to get four seats or to win four of the competitive elections. Do you think that there's an opportunity in 2018 to take majority, or is this going to have to be another two-cycle plan?
I mean, it's a very difficult map in 2018 with where we're at right now with 11. So I think we'll assess the seats. I mean, there's a number of open seats because of term limits, but I think we're going to be in a very competitive position in some of those districts to get to majority. That's tough. You play to win, of course. You look at the map and you figure out where you can play, and you know, you try to develop a plan for majority. But you know, if we can't get there at this time, I think we have to start. I think at the party we're looking more long term. I think for a long time we looked at each election, and that's all we focused on. I think now we're starting to see that you have to look at each election, but you have to have an eye on at the one after it too to make sure that you're building. But obviously, we wanted to be in a better position, but we're not. So we'll take a look at 2018. The likelihood is we're not going to get a position to win the majority, but I think we can be in a much better place than we are now.
All right, very good. Senate Minority Leader-elect Jim Ananick, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Tom Hickson from the Michigan Catholic Conference for joining us today, Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick. And for John Roerink and Craig Mauger, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.